This is Crucial Tech, a podcast about technology that affects all of us in a format that allows you to consume it in the time it takes to go to and from the grocery store. I'm your host, Lou Covey, and I probably know more about it than you do. And if I don't, I know someone who does. But first, this episode of Crucial Tech is brought to you by the Augmented Leadership Institute, a consultancy and research organization that partners with businesses and nonprofit organizations to create a post-industrial future of work together. And we thank you very much. Here's the thing about regulating digital technology. It involves at least four groups of people. The first one is us, the users. The second one is corporations, the people that make this stuff. Third is governments, and finally, industry standard groups. Well, the first two are not really reliable because, let's face it, most users would rather have oral surgery than do what needs to be done to protect themselves digitally online. And then the corporations are trying to make money. So the whole idea of security, which costs money and reduces profitability in the short term, doesn't really help much. So that leaves it to government regulations from people who don't know the difference between a thumb drive and a thumbnail, and industry standards groups. And it's those groups that create the research and the concepts that governments use to actually make an informed decision. So a few weeks ago, my partner, Patrick Buck, and I sat down at opposite ends of the world. He's in Germany, I'm here in California. We sat down with Scott Cadzo, who is, and here comes a very long title, the chair of the Specification Group for Securing Artificial Intelligence for the European Telecommunications Standard Institute, or ETSI, E-T-S-I. And we talked about the progress and problems of standardizing safe generative AI. So let's take it away, Patrick.
Scott, first of all, nice to meet you. Thanks for taking the time. Maybe we should start with sort of a general introduction of what you do, what ETSI is doing in terms of securing artificial intelligence. And maybe as a sort of like first question, which would be interesting to me, is since when does ETSI is busy with AI? Because I imagine you didn't start back in November when ChatGPT was released, did you?
No, we've been doing this now for just over 3 years, nearly 4 years. We started off basically as an academic exercise, trying to identify what was the problem with AI and what would it introduce as a security issue. So we started off doing essentially identifying the problem statement, identifying what intelligence meant, what artificial intelligence meant, and the impact that would have on security of systems in general. And since then, we've built a much bigger portfolio of work, which is, you've identified in the press release, but we're addressing things like how would you test AI? How would you give assurances of the existence of AI? How would you characterize the hardware? Does the hardware for AI cause a different problem than non-AI based hardware? And then building from there. So we've done a lot of reports, fairly academic, but leading into a really wide understanding of the application. And then along comes the AI Act, which kind of like changed our focus a little, but what we're trying to do to some extent is rationalize the debate, because most people think of AI by what they've seen in the movies or what they've seen on TV or what they've read in novels. And most of that's dystopian, verging on nonsense kind of. So we're trying to build some rationality into the debate. So it's not a case of, you know, James Cameron's movies coming to life. It's more a case of minor things like, the kind of things you see in everyday, environments, where you're looking at a set of, say, X-ray scans, and being able to much better identify the existence of a cancer or something similar. And those are positive things, whereas the kind of public debate we see nowadays isn't really our concern, whether you can use it to manipulate audiences. Well, yes, you can, because you can use the press to do the exact same. You can use news media to do the same. You can do social media without having to have AI. So I say we're trying to bring that rationality into the debate and then build features into systems that allow us to verify the authenticity of data, verify the integrity of data, make sure the processing is not going wildly off course, and then bringing that kind of security in into the system.
Okay. I got a question along that lines. Have you been surprised at the lack of quality in the output of generative AI?
Not surprised. More surprised that people think it's important.
Okay.
In that it's generally fairly low quality, and one of the things that I described it as a while ago was it's no better than a fairly low level school student, and it's kind of the reading age of most of the generative AI stuff is, kind of reading age of, 9 or 10 years old. It's certainly not the level you'd want. But the big thing about it tends to be grammatically really quite good. The spelling tends to be quite good, but the meaning is often just nonsense. And it's quite easy to identify. So people get really hung up on it because if you think of some of the people that are really worried about AI and particularly generative AI, they're worried about the less educated part of the population, and their AI definitely has an issue. You can't distinguish much between generative AI and the ravings of, some drunk guy down the pub, basically.
Yeah, that's I read an article a couple of weeks ago about that, and it was actually saying this is a positive thing. I couldn't quite figure out how it was positive, but it says generative AI makes it more affordable to produce low quality content. And I went,
Yeah, that'd be
okay.
reasonable.
And I think that's more in the area of marketing, which is I don't think is that big of a deal. We've been getting quite a few contributed articles submitted to us that we sort of wonder why is this written so bad? This guy has a PhD, okay? He should be better educated. He should be able to write better. And
Yeah.
we started using AI checkers, which admittedly are not perfect. They range anywhere from 30% to 70% accuracy. But they've been able to give us enough information to say, yeah, this was completely generated by an AI, or maybe 10% of it was generated by a human. And so that kind of thing has made it easy for us to make decisions on whether to accept or reject articles. Is that the kind of work that you guys are doing?
Yeah, well, that's part of the stuff we're doing. And really to identify whether, because one of the aims, certainly with things like the AI Act, and a lot of the work we're doing, is to make it clear and obvious that AI has been involved in the loop. So from a standards point of view, we expect people to do that voluntarily, so they should label things as being AI generated. But we're also looking at the ability of AI tools themselves to detect AI and say this is 90% likely to come from an AI machine, and therefore we can label it as suspicious at best. But yeah, we want to try and get rid of this kind of falsification of texts. And the problem, one of the problems you have, is that it's ChatGPT and other generative AI engines are fairly good at producing tens of pages of text, which you can use to bulk out your original material. So unfortunately, people are using it to as bulk feeder. Like you take your base idea, you use generative AI to produce some bulk around it, and it makes your one page dissertation suddenly into a 50 page dissertation. It doesn't make it any better. It just makes it more verbose. But that's the danger. People are using it as shortcuts for doing the hard work. And it doesn't take very long before you learn to pick up what's novel and human generated as to what's machine generated based on fairly old libraries and fairly old texts. I mean, something if you ask a lot of the texts to create a text, anything newer than, you know, than 18 months old, it just doesn't know about, you know, so it wouldn't know, you know, about, you know, say what's happening in Ukraine just now, it just wouldn't know about that. It might be able to infer something about it, but it doesn't know. It couldn't tell you the results of like today's stage in the Tour de France, which is really important to know. And those are the kind of things that you'd like it to be able to do, but it simply doesn't have the knowledge and capability. And there's a danger with AI in general, or certainly the way it's been portrayed, is that it gives you information which on a very superficial level looks okay, but once you study it, you begin to question whether it's actually of any value. And what we're trying to do in Etsy and across other standards bodies as well is try and filter through that and find techniques that allow us to essentially separate out the dross of AI from the value of AI, and then push AI towards actually being of use to us in society. So it will replace, I mean, one of the things we'd like to see is that human beings are put into less dangerous positions, because you can use machines driven by intelligence to do dangerous jobs for us. Because ultimately, if you lose a machine, it's just money you're losing, it's not a human life. Those kind of things we want to look at and build the debate back around what we want AI to do rather than what AI is doing. And the problem with what AI is doing is it's always doom laden. You know, it's you know, taking this vote away from us, it's giving us just false information or misleading us, and that we want to stop that.
Interesting. I mentioned that we've been using some AI checkers, mostly just to check to see how well they work. And we have found that there's a wide range of ability to determine whether something is AI. So some studies have shown that, you know, it's as low as 10% and some as high as 90%. But there are all kinds of reasons in between for why there's that range. And the work that you've been doing, what kind of accuracy have you been getting?
Well, we're not so much worried about, I mean, obviously we'd like to get in the high 90s in terms of accuracy, but what we're more concerned about is explaining the accuracy, you know, explaining why we came to that conclusion. So, you know, are the data sources reliable? If you do a search through data sources, is the conclusion you're going to reach a reasonable conclusion? So, you know, obviously, if you've got a large data set, depending on how you filter it, which is essentially all that AI is doing, you can reach multiple conclusions from it, and you've got to identify whether those conclusions are valid or not. So we are building up knowledge of how to interpret data in a way that allows the intelligence to be essentially verifiable, so that the decisions it makes or guides you towards are verifiable. And the other problem we have is a lot of our AI in real systems will be embedded. So it'll make decisions that you tend not to see. So things like autonomous driving, the AI is going to use image recognition, it's going to use mapping recognition, all those kind of things, all sorts of technologies together to try and lead it to a reasonable decision. The kind of thing we do as human beings, just naturally, we process our peripheral vision really well. We can detect, you know, things around us all unconsciously, but in a machine, you have to make those conscious. And what we've got to try and do is understand how we work as human beings and as human systems to try and build that knowledge back into the machines, and then give the machines the advantages that we have. And at the moment, most of AI doesn't do that. It simply looks at a static data set, and it doesn't know that data set is insufficient. We've got to be able to find find tools that allow us to recognize, I don't have, essentially for the AI to say, I don't know the answer because I don't have enough data. Most AI systems can't do that because they don't know they don't have the right data. And therefore they end up making conclusions or recommendations which are simply invalid because they're acting on incomplete data. Whereas we would say, I don't have enough data. Let's go and find some more.
That's probably at the basis for the AI hallucinations, because companies like OpenAI and Google have been trying to produce information that makes somebody happy that they've gotten the information. Okay, that's oversimplifying it, but so they'll just make stuff up so it makes it sound like you've given them the information they need. But isn't part of the problem also I think you mentioned the quality of the data. I mean, you can have a small data set, but if it's high quality data and it's for a limited purpose, you can have an AI that does really well. But when you're trying to do a large general AI, you know, and you're collecting information off the internet where 90% of it is crap, essentially it's going to produce the same amount of crap.
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem with Microsoft's chat engine. Microsoft's chat engine used Twitter feeds basically to identify how to answer questions. And the Twitter feeds it's reading were, they're incredibly biased, they're incredibly racist, they're sexist, all sorts of bad stuff. But they were the dominant features of the chats it is looking at. And so it learned that that was the best behavior to get recognized on as a good chat, a good partner in chat machines. But it's the wrong answer, it's the wrong question. And the problem with, as you suggest, if you've got really well tailored data, like good data, you don't need an awful lot of it to get good decisions. But if you've got just an overload of invalid data, you can make invalid trends. And there's a classic example of the murder rate increases at the same rate as ice cream sales. Well, so obviously, if you're not very intelligent, you'll say, well, if we stop selling ice cream, we'll stop murders. And is that really stupid? Both happen when weather's warm, because murderers like to go outside when it's warm, and they like to buy ice cream when it's warm. And the correlation is, there's a reasonable correlation, but there's no causation. And a badly designed AI will only find correlation and not try and seek causation, whereas good researchers will always try and find causation, what actually causes something to happen, and they'll discard bad data. An AI doesn't have genuine intelligence to discard bad data. And that's where we need to try and work out, what are we trying to generate? Are we just trying to generate good correlations, which hold up 99.9% of the time? Are we going to try and find good causation, which might only hold up for 80 or 90% of your data? So it's a much lower success rate, but it's a much better success rate. So we need to be careful to not to go for very good correlation finding as opposed to very good information finding. And that those are different things, and they have different understandings of intelligence. But a lot of our intelligence in machine learning for now is based on being able to do pattern recognition. And if you expand pattern recognition too far, it gets to the point where it gives you bad results. And part of that is also asking the wrong question of the data. So if you're, and it gets down to the same kind of problem we had a few years ago with SQL injection in databases, where you can actually write a command or write a query as a command. Now we're actually being able to write queries into AI machines, which are commands, and it tends to change the data. And again, we need to try and filter that out, identify that as a genuine threat, find a way to counter it. And those are things we need to build up. And unfortunately, we keep on getting kind of stymied, I think, by basically the social concerns around AI. Like, it's kind of like, it's the Luddite environment. These machines are coming to take away our lives, our jobs, our livelihoods. Therefore, they must be bad. And that's what we need to counter by giving, as I say, getting some rationality into the debate and getting and people to follow rational rules, which are not going to stop the development of AI, but allow AI to be developed in a positive fashion rather than the kind of ad hoc fashion it's doing just now.
Okay. I've got one more question, and again, I know I'm hogging the discussion here, but one thing that I thought that might help in this problem of whether you can trust AI or to know what it is attribution. I mean, that's one of the things I like about Wikipedia, is yeah. I will read something, and something in the back of my mind says, I'm not sure this is right, so I can just scroll to the bottom of the page, take a look at the references, and if the references don't match up, in other words, they're not trustworthy references, then I know I can pretty much throw out that particular piece of information. So it's just using some common sense and looking, where did you get that information?
Yeah.
Like the common thing on the internet where you say something that somebody disagrees with, where's your research? And okay, fine. But is there some way that we could automate that process to mandate attribution of content?
We can begin to do mandates, but whether we can automate it or not is more difficult. So a lot of things we're doing are things on like data supply chains, which is exactly that question. Where did you get the data from? What purpose is that data created for? And is the purpose that you're using it for matched to the original purpose that it was created? And then you get essentially a trustworthy ranking for that data. So if it was designed for recognizing cats out of a set of animals, and you start to try and use it for recognizing, I don't know, pigs out of animals, well, your data set's wrong, so you're using it for the wrong thing. So even if the data source is trustworthy, the data purpose is no longer trustworthy. And that's what we want to try and get across, is that people properly label their data as being for this purpose with this intent, and then you can start to build an overall chain of trustworthiness into it. Because then once you manipulate it or analyze it, you end up with a new set of data, and that's the chain becomes quite complex. But as long as you can tag it throughout its lifetime, you have at least a chance of staying ahead of the game. If you don't tag it in the first place and you just accept everything without weighting it, it's just going to be nonsense. What you come out of it, if you try and present it to any rational person as well-researched, they'll do exactly what you said. They'll ask, what is your source? How did the source come to? Why did you choose that source? And that's where we're trying to get to. So you get this overall integrity of the system, because you can trust its sources, you can trust that it's processed correctly, and you can trust that decisions are made have stand up in front of the data. If that makes sense.
Okay. I'm going to shut up now. I'll let Patrick ask some questions.
Well, I actually have a question, which I think you mentioned in the 009 report, the security of the platform, because I think that is interesting, and that's a sort of an attack vector where hackers might be, well, I don't know if they might be more successful, but basically, hacking the security or the platform where AI is running on, and thereby manipulating probably the outcome of what AI would have to say. So what's behind that, and is that already seen sort of in the wild?
We're not seeing it very much in the wild yet, but the research has shown that it is a viable attack, because as you say, you very much go and you modify, so your neural network weightings, and you can do that by feeding queries into it and modifying the feedback loop. So you drive the feedback, or you drive the decision making very slightly over time away from the preferred decision or the proper decision by manipulation of the feedback points. And if you can directly do that to the hardware without doing the data queries, that is going to be quite a powerful attack, because it's something you'd have to go and look at the machine for. So what we're trying to do is get an understanding of the role of specialized processors in the AI machine, Because up until now, what we kind of built neural coprocessors for, we've been building them for some time now, and they're now become endemic. You know, if you go and buy any Apple device, it has a multi-threaded neural coprocessor with it. So you've got that data to hand, you've got that capability to hand, and if you can manipulate the machine, then you don't need to worry about manipulating the data because you've got direct access to the machine. You can do that as side channel attacks and various other things. So we're very keen to not look at an AI as a single point of attack, you know, a single point of failure in your system. It's going to be quite distributed, and we've got to get a much deeper understanding of the entire supply chain of AI, you know, not just the hardware, not just the software, not just the intent, but everything together. That answers that, hopefully.
Okay, so that also means that all of these different components can be sort of hacked, and which makes those attack surface bigger, right?
The attack surface becomes much bigger than we prefer, and our job as security researchers, security standards experts, is to try and find ways to manage that attack surface to get to the point where we can minimize it. Because obviously our goal is in security is to minimize the entire attack surface. The problem with AI, it's massively increased the attack surface in ways that we still don't fully understand, but we're beginning to. And the quicker we get an understanding of how to contain the attack surface, the quicker we can build reliable, trustworthy, secure AI systems, which is our ultimate goal.
Okay, but especially in cybersecurity, I mean, in cybersecurity and in cybersecurity solutions as well, a lot of companies have already, before the emergence of generative AI, have said that they are using AI, which makes sense. Because of the you know, the huge number of bot attacks, it's sometimes difficult to sort of filter what is really an attack and what is just noise. And what I'm getting is basically sort of the defensive AI on the one hand side and the offensive AI. Will we see sort of AI wars, sort of like, you know, without any human intervention, that the defensive AI will tackle the offensive AI? And I think there were even sort of like competitions in I don't know, probably Black Hat or something, where software was asked to attack another software, and at the same time, if there were attack, immediately fix the vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that's going to become, I won't say the norm, but it's only going to become much more a powerful set of technologies, simply because you need, if your attacker is intelligent and mutable and changes their patterns, behavior in response to how you're defending yourself, it will become like two black belt martial artists coming against each other, where they continually change the form of attack to find the weaknesses in the opponent. And that's what we're going to see more and more. And that's where it's much more difficult from a security defense point of view to try and mitigate the attacks. Because what you tend to do is, if you look at, I mean, if you're protecting against a knife attack, you can wear a stab belt and various other things. But if somebody brings a gun to a knife fight, you're suddenly, you're not ready for it and you have no defense. And what we're going to have to worry about is, what is the equivalent of bringing a gun to a knife fight when you're an AI? What's the cumulative form of attack we're going to have to defend against? And that's a real challenge. And we're building that knowledge slowly. And as I say, events like Black Hat will really bring that to the fore. Our job in the security standards world is try and rationalize that into standardized, you know, mitigations, basically, against those bad guys, the bad actors, without being bad actors ourselves. And that's often quite difficult. And getting the right expertise into the groups is going to be a challenge, because unfortunately, defense doesn't pay quite as much as attack does. So we have to be prepared to fight against it, but we are building good friends and relationships in the various domains that need to be active. You know, like, as I say, the as you mentioned, the people like the virus protection guys, the network protection guys, they are now building knowledge that they're feeding back into the standards world, and we are going to be able to capitalize on that and make sure we can counter the worst impacts of AI used in defense and make AI useful in defense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we've actually did an interview with some researchers from Checkpoint along those lines. But if we look at the impact of AI currently, I mean, of course, the big cybersecurity companies, they do a lot of research, and I guess that they will, you know, it's a sort of cat and mouse game, right? They're trying to defend, and then the attackers try to attack in a different way and things like that. But there are also, if you look at the small and medium-sized businesses or private persons, they don't have the luxury of having all of these sort of cybersecurity solutions. So do you see sort of an immediate impact on the sort of general security of, well, the world, so to speak, or at least the small and medium-sized businesses?
It will, I mean, it's one of those things that all end up filtering down, and it's unfortunate that people who are going to be most defended and most capable of defending themselves will be the richer, larger organizations, because they've got the expertise to call on. They can afford to buy that expertise. One of the reasons that I'm particularly involved in standards is an ability to make those techniques available to everyone. And we want to bring essentially the entry point for defense down a lot. But that requires us to just keep plugging away. It will eventually get to the point where nobody should be excluded from the ability to defend themselves against AI. And what we want to do is make the solutions as marketable and easy to implement as possible. It's not a long-term goal. We're getting there, but standards are only part of the approach. Then there's a whole bunch of training that we have to encourage people to take account of. Awareness is one of our big issues. And in that case, we actually have to fight against some of the more dystopian press that we see around. You know, like, it's not all bad. Not all AI is bad. Some AI is bad. Some AI is good. And we just need to make sure we promote that we are doing work to protect people from the worst aspects of AI.
Yeah, I think especially awareness is probably but it has been, even before AI came about, I think awareness is the number one issue which we need to address in any case, because and especially now with AI, and that's again referring to the interview with Checkpoint, because what they said that all of the sort of the bad guys, especially the bad guys who are not native English speakers, for them it was in the past was relatively hard to phrase a sort of good phishing email because they were not native speakers. So they would either have to turn to a costly translator to create such a phishing email, or they would just create it themselves, but then it would easily be identified as a phishing email. But now with generative AI, it becomes much easier for them to start an attack.
Yeah.
Do you think we're ready for that?
Yes, to an extent, because the world is getting better at using tools, not necessarily AI tools. I mean, there have been good translation tools for a long time. Obviously, some of them had good, better or worse AI behind them, but they're now becoming much more commonly available. And yeah, it lowers the barrier to launching a successful attack. But then we have to, again, it's a case of informing, training, educating people to be just much more careful about what they do online. You know, just don't open every email. The kind of stuff that we've been telling people in the security world for a long time, don't trust without verification. And what we're doing across Etsy and the standards world is we're pushing much more towards that zero trust environment. Don't trust things until you've verified it. And if you verified it once, don't assume that that verification is going to work the next time around. Verify again and again and again. So getting that mindset, just possibly slightly paranoid, into our everyday work is going to be useful. And it's kind of like, I mean, you know, as a male, I don't take as much care when I walk out in the street, but as a, you know, women do. It surprised me how much more conscious some people are of dangers around them. We need to make people aware and conscious of the real dangers all the time. And that's getting rid of, it's changing attitudes. It's a hearts and minds thing. It's not just a technology thing, although technology is what's going to affect them. So we need to be more, as I say, more proactive in just giving people advice on how to recognize AI, how to recognize a threat, how to recognize or make verifications that something came from the right place. And as said earlier, you don't check your sources, check the sources of your sources before you act on something. And if people took that advice, we'd be in a safer place altogether.
Okay. Yeah, I completely agree. And well, I think it's still a road of, we still have a long road ahead of us. But maybe sort of general question, because some of the discussions around AI, of course, and you've probably seen the open letters, even including some of the AI researchers or company executives who sort of go into the danger of the sort of singularity, so AI taking over the world. What do you think of that? Are you sort of along the same lines, or you say no, that's not going to happen?
I don't think, I'm kind of more hopeful that people will not lead to that singularity where AI dominates our life. I kind of hope people are actually able to still go out and do things without being connected to the internet all the time and rely upon other sources of information. So I think it gets good press by saying there's the AI singularity has come along and they're going to wipe out humanity. In practice, we've gone through this kind of calamity before. In other technologies, we had the Industrial Revolution, 200 years ago. We survived that. We've had major revolutions in transport and funding and health. We've survived that. We are fairly adaptable animal when it comes down to it. We're also a very social animal, and the danger with being a social animal is that panic spreads very quickly, fear spreads very quickly, but so does confidence and good behavior. So we need to stress the confidence and good behavior in dealing with AI is just another thread in how we're going to live, rather than sort of entrenching ourselves in hiding away from it. Let's actually engage with it, engage with the developers of AI so we can actually make them work for us and not try and destroy us. So I'm not as skeptical as some, but I can understand where they come from, because they also watch Terminator far too often or other such movies. We can work through this if we're just open our eyes to the issues and then work alongside the issues rather than work and let those issues overtake us.
Yeah, I've actually read quite an interesting study on this, because the current generation of AI is obviously trained on data which was generated by humans. Now, yes, subsequent generations of AI might be trained on all that sort of hallucinations which is coming from the current generative AI generations. So the study actually said that the quality of AI might actually decrease over time the more content is produced by AI. So that sort of gives me a little bit of hope that, we will have AI. It will be very useful, but I also don't think it will take over the world. So.
Yeah, I mean, I have more faith in human beings or humankind than I do in machines. So.
Yeah, same here.
So that's it for this week on Crucial Tech. The transcript, the edited transcript of this conversation is in Cyber Protection Magazine, along with this podcast. If you have any questions or concerns or comments, you can reach us at cyberprotectionmagazine.com and just go there, and there's a place for you to leave your comments. And I want to thank our sponsors for helping put this together. And again, one more time, thank you to Etsy and Scott Cadzo for the work they're doing. nice to hear a technologist say he has more faith in humans than on machines. That's it for this week. This has been Crucial Tech, a Foot Washer Media production.